Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Well, it's been my privilege to get to know Walter over these years, and I very much appreciate him as a friend and as a fellow servant in this mission. We founded Reasons to Believe 20 years ago to communicate the new reasons to believe in Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. And yes, we have nothing against the traditional older reasons. It's just that it's been my experience, it's easier to engage people in something that was discovered last week than something that happened 2,000 years ago. So we use these new reasons as a bridge to the older and more traditional reasons. And what I'm going to do tonight is kind of take you on a quick journey through several scientific disciplines and give you a few of the highlights of some of these new reasons to believe. And the first book I ever read in cosmology, I was 7 years old at the time, was a book written by Fred Hoyle. And Fred definitely wasn't a believer. You could probably describe him as a pantheist. But he had done a lot of reading in the different holy books of the religions of the world. And in that book that I read at age 7, he made the point that the Bible, amongst the world's holy books, was the most extensive in its content about the origin and structure of the universe, and what it had to say was amazing in its content. Now, for all of his life, he rejected that content, but he did make the point that the Bible indeed is filled with this. And many years later, when I received a Gideon Bible, I actually began to go through the Bible and look up that content that Fred Hoyle had referred to. And what Fred notes in his book is that the Bible makes three critical points about the origin and structure of the universe. Namely, that the universe can be traced back to an ex nihilo beginning, an actual beginning not only of matter and energy, but space and time. It's a universe that continuously expands from that point of beginning, and it's a universe that gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. And those of you with some science background will recognize that these are the three fundamentals of all Big Bang creation models. And that really explains why Fred was opposed to the Big Bang all of his life. He saw it as a Christian model, and since he could not accept the Christian faith, he was committed to reject Big Bang cosmology. Now, as to where exactly the Bible makes these statements, these are a few of the verses in the Bible that talk about the singularity beginning. Genesis 1:1 is probably the most famous of these verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Hebrew phrase that's translated heavens and earth is a compound noun, a lot like our English word butterfly, which has got nothing to do with butter and nothing to do with fly. The Hebrew word for earth has 5 different literal definitions. The Hebrew word for heaven has 3 different literal definitions. But when you attach heaven's plural to earth's singular, it takes on a 9th definition, namely the entire physical universe, encompassing all matter, energy, space, and time. And when it says in the beginning God created, it uses the word bara, which means to create something brand new that never existed before. So it's referring to the first time appearance of matter, energy, space, and time. Now, when you get into the New Testament, you find passages like Hebrews 11:3 that makes a statement that the universe that we can detect was made from that which we cannot detect. While we scientists are quite capable of making detections within matter, energy, space, and time, but not beyond. And I don't have the passages up here, but it's the Apostle Paul that explicitly addresses the beginning of space and time and notes that the beginning of space and time is coincident with the beginning of the universe. Now, in terms of what scientific evidence do we have today for this singularity beginning, it traces back to 1970 with the publication of the first of the space-time theorems of general relativity. This is the research paper that launched Stephen Hawking to worldwide fame, Singularities of Gravitational Collapse in Cosmology. Now, this is a paper that's loaded with tensor calculus, but if you read the last couple of paragraphs, it kind of lays out exactly what this theorem has to say. And the power of the theorem is its generality. It's based on only two assumptions. Assumption number one, that we live in a universe that contains mass. And with most audiences, most people are prepared to accept that statement as true. If we got a skeptic here, we can get a bathroom scale out. The second assumption is not so trivial, namely that the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of the universe. And when this paper was published, astronomers had been successful in confirming the reliability of general relativity to the second place of the decimal. We knew it was right to within 1% precision. And back in 1970, that left a little bit of wiggle room for those who did not want to accept the conclusion of the theorem, namely that if the universe contains mass, and if the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of the universe, then there is a beginning to the universe, a beginning of space and time, and most significantly, there must exist a causal agent beyond space and time that's responsible for creating this universe of space, time, matter, and energy. And Hawking, in an interview with the Reader's Digest in 1974, made note of this theorem and said, "We prove that time is a beginning. We prove that time was created." But by that same token, he'd also proved that the universe must come about by the hand of a transcendent causal agent. And the distinction here is this. When you go through the holy books of the religions of the world, outside of the Bible, they talk about God or gods or forces creating the universe within space and time. What's unique to the Bible is its declaration that God creates independent or outside of space and time. So Hawking did more than simply prove that time was created. He proved that it's the God of the Bible that's responsible for bringing the universe into existence. However, in 1970, we could legitimately claim to have proof for the God of the Bible to only 1% precision. When I was a graduate student, there was efforts to try to extend that to the third place of the decimal. And when I arrived at Caltech, I met an astronomer there, Erwin Shapiro, from MIT and Harvard, who had successfully pushed it to the fourth place of the decimal. But thanks particularly to the discovery of binary neutron stars, these would be neutron stars that orbit closely about one another. And the theory of general relativity predicts that if you've got two neutron stars close enough together, their mutual gravity will cause their orbits to decay, or basically the neutron stars will slowly spiral into one another and merge. And there are now three binary neutron stars where we've been able to make careful measurements of this merging phenomena. And the bottom line is that we now recognize that the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of the universe to 15 places of the decimal. And whereas back in 1970, we had only four independent experimental proofs of the theory of general relativity, today we have 13. And right now we got the Gravity B probe, that $1.5 billion satellite that you taxpayers funded, orbiting above planet Earth, that's going to be measuring the lens-Thirring effect to four or five places of the decimal. That will provide us with a 14th test of the theory of general relativity. But Roger Penrose, when he was interviewed in the British Broadcasting Corporation, one of the co-authors of this paper, made note of the fact that because of these neutron stars and these dozen-plus tests that have been performed, general relativity today ranks as the most exhaustively tested and best-proven principle in all of physics. Legitimately, we have greater reason for confidence in the theory of general relativity than we do Newton's laws of motion, which really removes any basis for doubt of the conclusion of these space-time theorems. There really must exist this causal agent beyond space and time that's responsible for creating this universe in which we live. Now, it's correct, too, that this is the first of the space-time theorems of general relativity, the simplest of the space-time theorems. Hawking and Penrose produced this theorem in the limited case of classical general relativity. And after 1970, a number of theoretical physicists said, well, what about quantum gravity general relativistic models of creation? And over the last 30 years, there have been about 20 such theorems published. So that's the basis of this title here, the space-time theorems, plural. And these theorems have now progressed to the point where they cover all possible reasonable quantum gravity explanations for the origin of the universe. I mean, what we can say today is that the strength and number of experimental proofs for general relativity are growing. Every year they get stronger, but already general relativity ranks as the best proven principle in all of physics, and the theorems are becoming more generally applicable. And recently in the Astrophysical Journal, a couple of theoretical physicists tried to explore possibilities for escaping the conclusions of these space-time theorems. And what they concluded in their paper was that all reasonable cosmic models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity. Now, there are some of these explanations for the universe that are, quote, unreasonable. These are cosmic models that violate the laws of thermodynamics. But clearly such a universe would not permit the existence of life. And therefore, that's the basis of their statement. All reasonable cosmic models are subject to this relentless grip. Now, what we're advertising at Reasons to Believe is that we have a testable creation model that can be falsified or affirmed and is predictive, capable of predicting what scientists will discover in the future. And so I just want to show you a few of the predictions that we have made in print and what we think science will produce in the next few years of research. We predict, for example, that the scientific evidence for a single cosmic beginning, as opposed to multiple beginnings or no beginning, will grow. That evidence that time is finite rather than infinite would also increase. That general relativity will prove to be even more reliable than it is today. The evidence will grow for that. That the grip of the space-time theorems will become even more relentless than they are today, and hence the case for a transcendent causal agent will become even stronger than it is today, and that evidence for other miraculous acts will be found. Now, I want to expand on that last statement, because what we've done in establishing this transcendent causal agent and bringing about the existence of space and time, really, by any dictionary definition, is a miracle. And I would argue it's the biggest miracle that we could scientifically explore. After all, it's the beginning, the coming into existence, the creation of all of physical reality. Now, granted that we have scientifically established to 15 places the decimal that there's this miracle of the creation of the universe, that opens up the possibility that this causal agent beyond space and time may have chosen to perform other miracles. And so we use this as a way to open up the door to serious discussion of supernatural, superintelligent design. Now, I'm not trying to promote what I would call the paradigm of the intelligent design movement. Frankly, I think they're making a mistake by not identifying the designer and not basing their paradigm on a testable model. But what this does is tell us that at least from now on, science must be open to the possibility that there could be miraculous interventions on the part of this causal agent besides just the creation or the origin of the universe. Now, as much as the Bible says about the singularity beginning of the universe, the beginning of space and time, it actually says more about the expansion of the universe. Now, most English translations translate it that God stretches out the heavens. The verb there in the Hebrew is nata, and it's best translated the continual ongoing expansion of the universe. And in that sense, this comports with all of these Big Bang creation models. And notice that none of these passages are in Genesis. The first of them is in Job. And what Job says is that God alone is responsible for this ongoing continual expansion. That's repeated again in the Bible, making note of the fact that we should expect to find something supernatural in this expansion of the universe. Seven of these passages put it in the cal participle verb form, which means a God on an ongoing, continual basis from the past through the present into the future is controlling this expansion of the universe. Three of these passages put it in the cal perfect form, which means that when God created the universe in the beginning, He created it with a physics that would guarantee future, ongoing, continual expansion. Two of these passages, Psalm 104, verse 2, and Isaiah 42, 5, describe how the universe expands, continuously expands, as one would unfurl a tent in order to live in it. And the word picture there, in referring to the tent, is making note of the fact that the universe, like a tent, is a surface. The reality of a tent is its surface rather than its interior or its exterior. Likewise, astronomers today have recognized that the universe is a four-dimensional expanding system, ignoring for a moment the six small dimensions that accompany the four big ones, but that all the matter and energy and even the space-time dimensions, the space-time fabric, is confined to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. Hence, we see the validity of this tent word picture. Now, in terms of scientific verification for these biblical claims for this continual expansion of the universe, although before I go there, I want to make note of the fact that the Bible was the only holy book previous to the 20th century, the only book, period, that made mention of the continual expansion of the universe. It wasn't until Albert Einstein, 1916, that any scientist or philosopher commented or discovered or noted this property of the universe. So for 2,500 years, in the case of Job, over 3,000 years, we had the Bible alone making this statement that we live in a universe that continuously expands. But our first clue about this expanding universe came through Einstein's theory of general relativity. You solve the equations and it predicts an expanding universe based on the operation of gravity. And this isn't that difficult to understand. Gravity would work to slow down the cosmic expansion that would be built into the creation of the universe. And if you remember anything from your junior high physics class, it's that two massive bodies attract one another through the force of gravity. And the closer they are together, the more powerfully they would attract. Well, this would lead to a prediction that when the universe is young and therefore small, the matter pieces will be close together. And therefore, gravity should be quite powerful in its capacity to slow down the cosmic expansion when the universe is young. But as the universe gets older, the surface gets bigger, the mass of bodies get farther apart, and therefore gravity becomes progressively weaker and weaker in its capacity to slow down the cosmic expansion that's built into the creation of the universe. But in 1998, this paper was published in the Astrophysical Journal by Lawrence Krauss. Lawrence Krauss is chairman of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Case Western Reserve University, and he's also the leader of the fight to get rid of intelligent design in the public education curriculum. But in this book, or in this article, he predicted that astronomers were on the verge of discovering a second factor that would govern the cosmic expansion. And in the introduction of this paper, he states that when this second factor is finally discovered by astronomers, it will present the physics community with the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics. And he's referring to what we now call dark energy. And dark energy has been referred to in the popular press as the anti-gravity term for the universe. But that's really not correct. It's more accurate to refer to it as the anti-elastic band effect of the universe. And to show you what I mean, I brought an elastic band here to demonstrate. An elastic band has the property that the more you stretch it, the more energy it gains to force contraction. The surface of the universe acts like a gigantic anti-elastic band, such that the more you stretch that surface, the more energy it gains to force an even more rapid expansion of the universe. Now, you get the opposite prediction that you would from gravity, namely that when the universe is young, and therefore the space surface small, this dark energy be weak in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. But as the universe gets older and older, that surface gets bigger, and dark energy becomes progressively stronger and stronger in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. Now, in 1999, astronomers actually discovered this dark energy. In fact, Science magazine awarded that discovery the breakthrough discovery of the year. And it's the only factor that's won that prize twice. In 2002, it won again, breakthrough discovery of the year, because that was the year that astronomers had made the first reasonably accurate measurement of this dark energy, and for the first time established that dark energy is the dominant component of the universe. Such that today we realize that the universe in the first 8 billion years of its history was slowing down in its expansion, and the last 6 billion years it's been speeding up. But Lawrence Krauss referred to this as the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics for the following reason. If you expand the universe too quickly, the bits and pieces of matter will not be able to coagulate under the influence of gravity to make galaxies, stars, and planets. The universe will be forever dispersed gas, and as such, there will be no possibility for life to exist anywhere, anytime. But if you expand the universe too slowly, then gravity is so effective that it collapses all the mass of the universe into neutron stars and black holes. And neutron stars and black holes have a minimum density of 5 billion tons per level teaspoonful. And at those extreme densities, molecules are impossible, atoms are impossible, even protons and electrons are impossible, and consequently life would be impossible. And in this paper, Lawrence Krauss calculates just how carefully you have to fine-tune or choose the value of the mass of the universe to get the just right gravity and the dark energy term. And what he points out is if you were to vary the mass of the universe by as little as one part in a quadrillion, 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 there'd be no possibility for the universe to form the kinds of stars and planets that would make life possible. But in terms of the dark energy, he discovered that the fine-tuning was even more extreme, that if you were to change the value of the dark energy constant by as little as one part in 10 to the 120th, 120 zeros after the one, there'd be no possibility for the stars and planets that would make any kind of physical life possible. And since he comes from an atheistic perspective, he termed this the most extreme fine-tuning problem. Indeed, I would argue this would be a huge problem for someone coming from a non-theistic perspective. And to help you understand that point, I'd like to compare that one part in 10 to the 120th. And by the way, Roger Penrose is on record as saying it's really one part in 10 to the 240th, 240 zeros, instead of just a mere 120. But just look at the mere 120. We can compare that fine-tuning to the very best example we can come up with of human engineering design achievement. And as I've looked at the literature, the best example I can find is that amazing gravity wave telescope that was designed by Caltech and MIT physicists. And after 10 years of hard engineering work and the generosity of the U.S. taxpayer, this thing has now been online for the past year. This instrument is so incredibly fine-tuned and designed, it can make measurements to one part in 10 to the 23. It still ranks as the only instrument we have that has any possibility of detecting gravity waves. But if we compare that one part in 10 to the 23 to one part in 10 to the 120th, it tells us that this causal agent beyond space and time, at a minimum, must be 10 to the 97 times more intelligent and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT physicists, and at least that many times better funded than the U.S. taxpayer. Now, the point here is we're no longer talking a transcendent causal agent that's impersonal. If you're talking intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power, those are attributes that you could only apply to a personal being. So this takes us to the next level. We're talking a causal agent that's personal and a causal agent that manifests these personal attributes to a degree that's orders and orders and orders of magnitude beyond what we human beings can achieve. Now, having looked at the Hindu faith, the Buddhist faith, and the Islamic faith, what I discovered there is a God that's not as involved as a Christian God claims to be, and a God that is not as capable as a Christian God in being able to fine-tune and design his creation. So this is not only a tool for distinguishing between the Christian faith and an atheistic worldview perspective, it allows us to distinguish between Christianity and other religious systems that are out there. Now, I'd like to show you another paper. This is the preprint that was posted on the Los Alamos website, written by three theoretical physicists, one from MIT and two from Stanford University. And it's titled, Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant, which is another term for this dark energy. And I'm going to pull two quotes out of this paper. And I want to remind you that all three of these theoretical physicists are atheistic in their worldview perspective. And the first comment they make in this paper is that arranging the universe as we think it is arranged, that is, with a dark energy term, would have required a miracle. I find that an interesting statement coming from three atheists. And here's a second pull quote from the paper. An external agent, namely external to space and time, intervene in cosmic history for reasons of its own. But these three gentlemen found this conclusion based on dark energy, namely that there's this agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own, to be so disturbing that they wound up concluding their research paper with this sentence. This is the last sentence in their paper. Quote, the only reasonable conclusion is we do not live in a universe with a true cosmological constant. In other words, they said this is so disturbing, this conclusion of this causal agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own, we are forced to conclude that dark energy is wrong. And they wound up predicting that astronomers would soon disprove this dark energy term. Well, the irony of this paper was it was posted on the Los Alamos website just a few weeks before astronomers came up with their most compelling evidence for the reality of dark energy. You'll find all these posted on our reasons.org website. You'll actually see the research papers I referred to there. And today we have 9 independent confirmations that this dark energy is real. And 4 of these measuring techniques are able to determine the quantity of dark energy to about 1% precision, and all 9 of them tell us that dark energy is the dominant feature of the universe, making up 72% of the total stuff of the universe. Bottom line, dark energy isn't going away. And we're on record as predicting that the evidence for dark energy will get stronger in 2006 than it was in 2005. And so we really are stuck with this causal agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own. Now, so far, I've covered 2 design features for the universe, arguably the 2 most spectacular evidences we have for supernatural design. In fact, dark energy ranks as the most spectacular evidence we have across all the scientific disciplines where we can actually attach numbers to it. But if we were to look at the gross features of the universe, we would find many characteristics that similarly show this evidence for exquisite fine-tuning. All four of the forces of physics, for example, must be exquisitely fine-tuned. For example, the ratio of the electromagnetic force to the gravitational force, if that were to vary by 1 part in 10,000 trillion trillion trillion, there'd be no possibility for physical life anytime, anywhere in the universe. And here are a few more. The age of the universe is critical. There's only one age where human life would be possible, for example. The velocity of light, the homogeneity of the universe, the entropy of the universe. And if you go to our reasons.org website, we post there for you 74 separate cosmic features or laws of physics that must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make life possible. And then we give you the research papers so you can check it out for yourself where these measurements were made. But while I was preparing to come here, we've actually been looking at the past year's worth of discoveries that have been published, and we'll soon be putting up on our website an expanded list that will give you 86 cosmic design characteristics. Now, in terms of measuring the universe, we are still limited by our telescopes and instruments and how accurately we can measure the gross features of the universe. When we look at our Milky Way galaxy and our solar system, because they're so much closer to us, we're able to measure them much more precisely and in much greater detail. And as we do that, we discover that there's this heavenly body problem. Not any old galaxy will do. It's got to be a very special kind of galaxy, so special that many astronomers conclude the Milky Way galaxy is alone in its capacity to support advanced life. Likewise, it takes a very special kind of star. Our sun is unique in its capacity to be able to sustain a life support planet around it. In fact, every one of the gas giant planets plays a critical role in sustaining life on planet Earth, most importantly Jupiter, but all four of them play this important role. And obviously the planet needs to be just right, and even the moon must be just right. And to give you an illustration of this, I've got a 3-minute video clip here which shows you some of the new evidence for the design of the moon that makes life possible here on planet Earth. Let me get this started for you. Whoops, back up one. This worked earlier. Here we go.
Exploration enabled us to confirm that lunar rocks differ chemically from Earth rocks. Through study of lunar rocks' radioactive decay, researchers discovered that the moon is, in fact, nearly 100 million years younger than the Earth. In the 1990s, a theory explaining the moon's existence gained wide acceptance in the scientific community. According to this theory, an object the size of Mars crashed into the newly forming Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. Most of the object's mass was absorbed by the Earth, but this collision also sent up a huge cloud of dust and rocky fragments all around the Earth. In time, gravity pulled those fragments together into one solid body, the Moon. The Earth, meanwhile, lost its entire atmosphere, and a new, much thinner one began to form from gases released by Earth's crustal material. Such a collision may seem a disaster, but it proved just the opposite. It set in motion certain alterations to Earth's features that eventually made this planet a uniquely suitable site for life.
The odds against a collision benefiting the eventual support of human life are staggering. The planet colliding with the Earth would need to be the right size, moving at the right velocity, striking at the right angle, made of the right materials, and occurring at the right time in the development of planet Earth. If any one of these factors were off by just a few percent, the Earth would be barren today.
Unless that impact had occurred, Earth's atmosphere would be much heavier than it is, even heavier than that of our neighboring planet, Venus. Venus's thick carbon dioxide-filled atmosphere would mean instant death for all possible life. The extra mass Earth gained from the collision, along with its atmospheric revision, meant that water could exist on Earth in all three states: ice, liquid, and vapor.
And those are three critical requirements for advanced life. Not that you just have a planet with water, but a planet that has an abundance of water in all three states. Now, it was Dave Walton from Britain who made note of the fact that if there's any basis for concluding that the moon was somehow intelligently designed to make life possible here on planet Earth, we should be able to research the moon in more depth and discover additional design features. And that was the question he was asked. And he was asking it from a skeptical perspective. You know, he comes from an atheistic worldview perspective, but he said if there's any validity to this design of the universe and the solar system for the benefit of life, then we should expect to find some predictive value in this anthropic principle. And so what he did in this research paper published in Astrobiology is to look at the moon to see if indeed there was this predictive feature of this anthropic principle. And the thing he noted was that this collision, which led to the formation of the moon, in all the model simulations that have done, results in an Earth that rotates very quickly as a result of the collision, about 2 hours a day. And then he looked at the moon and noted that one of the things the moon does to make life possible on planet Earth is to stabilize the tilt of the rotation axis. I mean, if you look at the other planets in our solar system, the rotation axis will tilt back and forth by about 60 degrees over the course of a few million years. If planet Earth did that, that would be deadly for life. We have this nice stable tilt of the rotation axis thanks to the fact that we've got a small planet orbited by a single gigantic moon. But Dave Walton began to investigate the mass of the moon and its capacity to stabilize the tilt of the rotation axis. And what he noted is you get a stable tilt if the moon were to be 50% of its current mass or 100% of its current mass. But in looking at that 100%, he made note of the fact that the moon, if it were even very slightly larger, by just a percent, that would disturb the ability of the moon to stabilize our rotation axis. So the question he posed in this paper, is there something we're missing about the feature of the moon? Why is the moon at the largest possible mass to stabilize the tilt of the rotation axis? And as he worked through the dynamics of the Earth-Moon system over the course of the past 4.5 billion years, he discovered that unless the moon is as massive as it is, at the hairy edge in terms of mass to turn the tilt of the rotation axis into an unstable condition, the rotation of the planet would not slow down to 24 hours in the time frame that's critical to bringing human beings on the scene just 3.8 billion years after the first life shows up on the planet. And therefore, he points out in this paper, indeed, this anthropic principle is testable and is predictive, namely that we're finding more design features as we study the moon in more detail. And to summarize, what we're looking at here is, if the non-theists are right, and there's no creator that's responsible for these features of the universe, then you would predict that as astronomers learn more about the universe and the solar system, then the number of evidences indicating design would decrease. And the fine-tuning nature would become less spectacular rather than more spectacular, and consequently, evidence that Christ is a designer would get progressively weaker and weaker as we learn more and more about the universe. On the other hand, if the non-theists are wrong and we Christians are right, the more we learn about the universe and the solar system, we should expect that these divine design evidences will increase both in strength and in number, and that evidence for Christ as a designer will get progressively stronger. Well, here we have Dave Waltham, not a Christian, signing in saying the evidence is increasing that we're looking at a creator as opposed to a no creator. And our scientific team at Reasons to Believe has been working over the past 15 years, going through the scientific literature and trying to determine, does the evidence get stronger for a creator, specifically the creator God of the Bible, or does it get weaker as we learn more and more? And what we've been doing on our reasons.org website is kind of tracking for you the history of the last 4 or 5 years. And to give you an example, this is a state of affairs in May of 2002. Surveying the scientific literature, we found 202 different characteristics of our Milky Way galaxy and the solar system that must be fine-tuned in order to make life possible here on planet Earth. And taking into account that many of these 202 characteristics do involve some dependency, and that the planets, after all, in the universe might be quite numerous, and I purposely chose the most optimistic estimate in the scientific literature, namely Carl Sagan's estimate that the universe contains 10 billion trillion planets. Well, even with that many planets, and even being very generous about the dependency factors, the bottom line probability, less than one chance in 10 to the 217 that you're going to find a body with the ability to support advanced life without invoking miracles. That's May of 2002. If we move ahead 22 months, we have 322 characteristics. So we added 120 characteristics in a little less than 2 years, and now the probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 282. And over the course of the past week, I've been working with our staff on trying to update this so we can put a new publication up on our website. And so far, we've only gotten to October of 2004. So this just takes you forward 6 months. And in that six-month period, we've gone from 322 to 423 characteristics. So 100 new characteristics were discovered and published in just a six-month window, and now the probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 392. So this is a dramatic demonstration that the evidence is exponentially getting stronger as we learn more and more for this God of the Bible being responsible for these features of the universe, the galaxy, and the solar system. Now, I advertised that I was going to spend some time dealing with the complex sciences. I mean, my specialty is the simple sciences of mathematics, astronomy, and physics, but let me introduce you to the complex sciences of chemistry, biology, and anthropology. And I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. This subject of the origin of life is covered in our book titled Origins of Life, written by myself and the biochemist Fuzz Rana that's on our staff. But to summarize, as we look at planet Earth, what we notice is the origin of life happens without the benefit of time, without the benefit of a prebiotic soup, and there's no natural source of homochirality, getting all the amino acids and nucleotide sugars either lined up left-handed or right-handed. And I say, how can you demonstrate that the origin of life happened without time? I mean, as I pick up the high school biology textbooks that are used, I see the Carl Sagan mantra that the origin of life is explained by the primordial Earth having this vast ocean, a prebiotic soup, the oceans of the world loaded with these prebiotic molecules, and over the course of a billion years, these prebiotic molecules self-assemble into the simplest life form that he claims is much simpler than the simplest life we see on planet Earth today. Well, the reason why we know that this happens without the benefit of time is looking at the cratering of the Moon, of Mercury, and Mars. And in those bodies, we see all these craters, and each of those bodies has a small atmosphere, a different kind of atmosphere. But based on that, we can determine what the erosion rate would be of those craters. And in all three bodies, it testifies of a vast inner solar system bombardment that peaked 3.85 billion years ago. And then a recent publication demonstrates that you have Jupiter and Saturn drifting outward early in the history of the solar system, and when they reach what's called the 1-2 resonance, that sets off this bombardment of Kuiper Belt comets and asteroids into the inner solar system, and likewise that too has been dated at 3.85 billion years ago. Now, as much damage as we see on the Moon, the Earth would have taken 30 times the damage because it's got a 30 times larger gravitational signature. And as such, now you can see this again posted on our website, a research paper in Geophysical Review makes note that this would have liquefied the surface of the Earth at least 200 kilometers deep into a lava ocean that would have been a minimum of 3,000 degrees centigrade. Obviously, such a condition would make the existence of life impossible. But the other thing you see in that research is that it would take 50 million years for this liquid magma ocean to cool enough where you could get rocks and the water, liquid water, showing up in the face of the Earth, and therefore the possible existence of life on planet Earth. Then you go to the chemistry. You look in these carbonaceous postbiotic material in the face of the Earth. Postbiotics are carbonaceous molecules that we know are the decay products of once living organisms. And it has the property that it exhibits a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 than non-organic material, stuff that does not come from once living organisms. And in looking at these carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratios, scientists determined that life has been abundant on planet Earth as far back as 3.80 billion years ago. Well, all of you can do the math. You take 3.85 billion, subtract 50 million years, that gives you 3.8 billion years. Subtract 3.8 from 3.8, that leaves you with zero time, at least in a geological perspective, for the origin of life. And we can use that same carbon-12 to carbon-13 analysis to determine if planet Earth ever had a prebiotic soup. Prebiotics would have a different ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 than postbiotics. What we discover is all of the carbonaceous material on planet Earth, all the way back to when that carbonaceous material showed up, is 100% postbiotic. Planet Earth never had a prebiotic soup. And it was a Romanian physicist a few years ago who published a paper demonstrating why. It's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. If you've got oxygen in the environment of the Earth, in the atmosphere, in the ocean, that will be toxic to prebiotic chemistry. Immediately shuts it down. But if you don't have oxygen, there will be no ozone shield, and therefore ultraviolet radiation will stream in from the sun, and ultraviolet radiation, just like oxygen, immediately shuts down prebiotic chemistry pathways. So it's a lose-lose situation. If you have oxygen, it can't happen. If you don't have oxygen, it can't happen. Which is why the Origin of Life research community has abandoned planet Earth as a site for the origin of life. From a naturalistic perspective, they're saying it's impossible. And that really explains why astrobiology today is the most rapidly accumulated discipline in terms of federal funding. In fact, their funding has gone up 4 times in the last 5 years. Now, in looking to outer space, the only place in outer space where there's any possibility for prebiotic chemistry would be these interstellar molecular clouds. And indeed, in these clouds, as of last count, they have found 123 different hydrocarbon molecules. But they have found no ammonia, no water, no nucleobases, none of the sugars that are relevant for life. They have found 3 carbon sugars, but none of the 5 and 6 carbon sugars that make up DNA and RNA, and no amino acids. Now, a few of you might be remember that in the textbooks, there's this claim that glycine, the simplest of the amino acids, has been found in molecular clouds. However, in the Astrophysical Journal, roughly about a year ago, that claim was withdrawn. They said, we've misidentified the spectral lines. And likewise, a claim that they had found the simplest of the nucleobases, that too has been withdrawn. And so, as it now stands, nowhere in the universe do we see any evidence for these prebiotic molecules. And even if there was some exotic site somewhere in the universe that we haven't been able to explore, the problem is there's no way to transport those prebiotics from that site to planet Earth. As dust moves through interstellar space that might contain some of these prebiotics, X-ray radiation and ultraviolet radiation will break them down. And they will break down if they spend too much time traveling in interstellar space, and literally only a few 100 years is enough to bring about that breakdown. And certainly when they come through the Earth's atmosphere, such molecules would be broken down. And so at the last Origin of Life research conference that both Fuzz Rod and myself attended, they concluded that the only way this transport could happen is if these prebiotics were encased in a gigantic rock that was a minimum of 2 meters in diameter, where you got the prebiotics right in the middle. That would provide enough protection from the X-ray and ultraviolet radiation. But at that same Origin of Life conference, we have the astronomer Jay Melosh calculating how many interstellar rocks land on Earth. And he concluded that if we count all rocks bigger than the size of a human fist, we get 1 every 10 to the 16 years. What's 1 million times older than the age of the entire universe? And therefore, at that conference, one of the researchers came to the microphone and said, we've eliminated the Earth, we've eliminated Mars, we've eliminated the moons of Jupiter and Titan, we've eliminated other planetary systems, we've eliminated everything in the universe. The only possible explanation that's left, he said, is that aliens must have sent a spaceship to planet Earth 3.8 billion years and have planted life here. And he said they probably came back for the Cambrian explosion as well. So that would explain two problems here. However, it misses two questions. How do you explain the origin of the aliens, and how could they possibly travel through interstellar space without killing themselves and the life on board? And that's something we address in this book, Lights in the Sky, Little Green Men, a book about UFOs and extraterrestrials, where we make the point that regardless of technology, there's simply no way that you can traverse long distances of interstellar space and to keep the life on board alive. So what's left over? Well, what's left is something that Stuart Kaufman has commented on. There must be a hidden law of physics that spontaneously reverses the second law of thermodynamics. In fact, he refers to it as a fourth law of thermodynamics, where he claims there are exotic sites in the universe where instead of the second law of thermodynamics, you get the opposite, where you would have simple, unordered, chaotic systems that spontaneously assemble themselves into highly ordered, complex, information-rich systems. Or you go along with the transcendent, supernatural, superintelligent being we see described in the pages of the Bible. Now, in terms of this hidden law, the problem is two of the features of the universe that must be fine-tuned to make life possible is that the universe must be extremely homogeneous and extremely uniform. That demand for homogeneity and uniformity rules out the possibility of a hidden law of physics. If such a law were to exist, we would sufficiently disturb that uniformity and homogeneity so that life would be impossible anytime, anywhere. So it seems to leave us with just one conclusion. And I'll spend the remaining few minutes dealing with perhaps the most controversial issue in this creation-evolution discussion, namely, where did man come from? In terms of the evolution or the origin of the human species, Francisca Ayala, one of our nation's most prominent evolutionary biologists, he's at the University of California, Irvine, a couple of years ago went through the exercise of saying we all know that the first life on planet Earth was bacteria. Let's start with that bacteria, and we're going to assume that Darwinian evolutionary processes work at maximum efficiency. So he took the most optimistic estimates of how natural selection, mutations, and gene exchange could propel the development of new species. And what he tried to determine was the probability that starting with bacteria, in the course of 3.8 million years, you would wind up with human beings or something that had the equivalent intelligence of human beings. And he found that the probability was one chance in 10 to the millionth power. Now, that's a million zeros after the one. And he forgot about the physics. And so there were three physicists, Tipler, Carter, and Barrow. John Barrow, Frank Tipler, and Brandon Carter, who said, let's redo Francisca Ayala's calculations where we take into account that the Earth rotates five times more slowly than it did when life first showed up on planet Earth, that radiometric decay is only 20% of what it was, and the sun has changed in its brightness by 15%, and a few other factors. And then they came up with a probability that it was less than one chance in 10 to the 24 million that you could start with bacteria and wind up with human beings from an evolutionary perspective. But to give you some feel for what these numbers are really like, one chance in 10 to the million, that be equivalent to winning the California lottery 125,000 consecutive times where you buy one ticket each time. Or as one of my colleagues pointed out, it's also the probability of winning the California lottery 125,000 consecutive times where you don't buy any tickets at all. In other words, now, you say, why would an evolutionary biologist like Francisca Ayala, who definitely is a Darwinist, would come up with such a calculation. Well, when you read his research paper, his goal was not to prove that we human beings are impossible from an evolutionary perspective. His goal was to prove that the existence of extraterrestrial intelligent life was impossible. But what he missed in his paper, it would also apply to our species just as much as it would apply to the existence of extraterrestrial intelligent aliens. Now, from a biblical perspective, we have the claim that Adam and Eve were the last of God's creation miracles. You know, for 6 days God creates, on the seventh day in which we still reside, he rests. So from a biblical perspective, there would be no divine miraculous interventions in making new life once human beings show up on the scene. And that really explains the lack of speciation evidence we see in the post-human era and the abundance of it that we see in the previous to the human era. It also makes the point that the human species is alone. It's unique and it manifests spiritual attributes. You know, we are the only species that ask questions like, why am I here? Where am I going? What's going to happen to me after I die? Is there a God? Our dogs and cats don't ask such questions. Now, what we've done at Reasons to Believe is to go through the Bible and do the best we can to calculate a biblical date for God creating Adam and Eve. And we've done that through calibrating the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. I won't go into the details, but we have a strong historical date for when Abraham lived, namely about 4,000 years ago, and we've got an accurate carbon 14 date for when the Bering Land Bridge broke, something that's referenced in connection with Peleg, who's halfway down the genealogy from Noah to Abraham. Simply assuming that the lifespans that are recorded there are proportional to the passage of time, you get a date for the creation of Adam at 50,000 years ago. Now, we can compare that with our best anthropological data, and what we see in anthropology is that we have a number of these cultural big bangs. We notice that there's this big bang of language that erupts 40,000 years ago, and there's this curious jewelry big bang. Now, when you look at the bipedal primates that preceded the human species, Neanderthals and Homo erectus, for example, we do see that they have a limited selection of tools, basically tools that you would make by taking a hammer rock and smashing it against a core rock, where you shatter the core rock into pieces and pick up the flakes and use those flakes to scrape meat off the bones. But when human beings show up on the scene, you immediately see this burst of advanced tools. Hammers and axes and shovels and needles and fish hooks. And you also see jewelry. But the bipedal primates that preceded human beings, zero jewelry. As soon as humans show up on the scene, there's this explosion of jewelry, about 10 times as much jewelry as you have tools. I think the same thing is true in the 21st century. We have about 10 times as much jewelry as we do have tools. But the whole point is, this suddenly erupts upon the scene 40,000 years ago. And anthropologists, this is something we note in our book, our most recent book, Who is Adam? Is that what you see with clothing is that you have these Neanderthals. They're much stouter than we are, short legs and short arms, barreled chest, a huge nasal capacity, much heavier than we are, obviously much better adapted to living in a cold climate than we are. Nevertheless, we see the first humans living in a climate zone that's 15 degrees colder than what the Neanderthals lived in. Obviously, the first humans were wearing clothes, and Neanderthals were not, which is why humans with their skinny bodies nevertheless were able to live in a much colder climate. And they've actually found the evidence that that clothing, not just the sewing tools, but the actual clothing itself. And then art and music likewise suddenly burst upon the scene about 33,000 years ago. Now, some of you might complain that aren't these dates later than 50,000 years ago? Well, 50,000 years ago is when you've got two people on the face of the earth. Two people are not going to leave much in the way of archaeological artifacts. You literally have to wait for the human population to grow to a sufficient degree that they're going to leave behind discoverable remains. So in that sense, the 40,000 years is consistent with the 50,000. But what's brand new and is really the heart of our book, Who is Adam, is we now have recovered DNA from the most ancient humans, and we recovered DNA from Neanderthals. And this allows us to test theories of human origins that before could not be put to such a rigorous test. In particular, what geneticists have done is to take samples of mitochondrial DNA in different ethnic groups all over the planet. And in looking at the differences in that mitochondrial DNA, they can determine whether or not the human population is descended from many women or one woman, many locations or one location. And if they can dig up people that have been dead for a known number of years, then they can calculate how far back these first humans would be. Well, the answer is as follows, that the human species is descended from one or a very few women that lived in one place. And the date you'll see in the scientific literature is that this first woman lived 150,000 years ago. But that's assuming that there's no heteroplasmy or triplasmy in the mitochondrial DNA. Now, what happens is about 10% of us get a little bit of mitochondrial DNA from our fathers. And some of us actually get not just two copies, but three copies. And so what this does is change the dynamics of the mitochondrial DNA dating, where if you take fully into account the heteroplasmy and triplasmy, you wind up with a 50,000-year date for when that first woman lived. And the scientific literature, she's referred to as mitochondrial DNA Eve. Well, on the male side, just like we all get mitochondrial DNA from our mothers, and most of us not from our fathers, all of us men here in the audience get our Y chromosomes exclusively from our fathers. And so the only way my Y chromosome can be different from my dad's is if I experience a natural mutation. And so geneticists do the same thing. They survey men all over the planet, look at the differences in the Y chromosome, dig up men that have been dead for a known number of years, and they can test, are we descended from one man or many men, one location or many locations? And the answer is one man. And they refer to him as the Y chromosome Adam. And here we get a more precise date that this first man lived 42,000 to 56,000 years ago. And this is referred to in the scientific literature as the Garden of Eden hypothesis. Now, I'm not saying all the geneticists doing this research are Christians, but they do recognize that the analogy to the biblical story is so close, it warrants referring to this as the Garden of Eden explanation, and they refer to the first man as Adam and the first woman as Eve. And I'm noting here we're getting the same date for this first man and first woman, and the same location as what we see recorded in the Bible. But most interesting of all is what's referred to in the scientific literature as the younger Adam paradox, that the best place to do these kinds of studies is with populations where there's very little migration in or out. Now, that wouldn't be true here in Texas, and it's certainly not true in California, but it would be true in nations like Japan, Estonia, Finland. It would be true of the Jews, and it's true of the Armenians. There's very little intermarriage with people outside that ethnic group. And when you do these kinds of DNA studies, what you discover is that you've got the first woman living thousands of years before the first man. Consequently, they call this the younger Adam paradox, and from a non-theistic perspective, this is a real problem. How can you have the first woman living thousands of years before the first man? But from a biblical perspective, this is exactly what you would predict. You've got these Y chromosomes not stopping at Adam, according to the Bible, but stopping at Noah. Because the story of the flood is how the whole human species is descended from eight people, four men and four women. But there's a big difference between the four men on board Noah's Ark and the four women. The four men are all blood-related to that one man, Noah. And so Y chromosome analysis, from a Christian perspective, will bottleneck at Noah. You're not going to be able to trace it back to Adam, only back to Noah. But the four women on board the Ark are not blood-related. They're the wives of the three sons and Noah. And therefore, the mitochondrial DNA bottleneck could easily go back thousands of years before the flood account that we see there in Genesis.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.